The Role of Truth in Biblical Faith, the eighth talk in a series titled Christianity and Truth, was presented by Nancy Scott on November 13, 2001, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
Tonight, I'm going to be our speaker, and I'm going to have a short talk on the role of truth in biblical faith. And I've asked Larry and Wes to join me as a panel to have a panel discussion. And so the format tonight will be a little bit different. I'm going to talk for a few minutes in the beginning, and then Larry and Wes and I are going to talk amongst ourselves, ask each other questions and dialogue about these issues. And then probably after 20 or 30 minutes of that, we'll open it up for a group discussion. And tonight we have new technology in the room tonight, although we don't have speakers in here, you can tell, so I'm going to be shouting a little bit. And let me know if you can't hear, and I'll turn the volume up a little bit. But the new technology is that we have a cordless mic for if you have a question, we can have Leah has offered to be our volunteer mic transporter. And so when you raise your hand to ask a question, wait for Leah to bring you the cordless mic. And when you get it, I'll say this again at that time, but I've been instructed that you need to pretend you need to eat it. Kind of put it right up to your mouth like this. So, okay. So, without further ado, I was tasked with talking on the topic of the role of truth in biblical faith. And as a result, I did some reading in the book of John, and I wanted to share some things that I discovered in that reading, first of all, and wanted to talk about three particular passages in the book of John. And what I've decided I would do is actually go through them backwards, start with the last one first, and then end with the first one, because that's the one I want to talk a little bit more about. So if you brought a Bible, you might open to the book of John. It occurred to me as I was looking at it that the Gospel of John is unique in some ways. It's not one of the synoptic Gospels, but it actually adds to the story of Jesus' life and ministry in significant ways that the other three Gospels, things that they leave out, John covers, and things that John covers, they don't cover. And so they're a good package sort of thing. But I really noticed that John's gospel, he really focuses a lot on the issue of who Jesus is as bringing the truth from God. And so that was kind of the theme that I recognized in the book this time and wanted to sort of underline all the different times. There's a whole lot of references to truth in the book of John, and I'm certainly not going to cover all of those. But I want to just look at a few of those passages and focus our attention on the idea that there is nothing really more central to our striving for sanctification than our understanding of truth and our acceptance of truth. And so as we strive to be good as God is good, there is not really anything more core than how we end up embracing the truth. And the truth can be a lot of there's a lot of pieces of that. The truth about who God is, the truth about who Jesus is, and the truth about who we are and how we respond to that are kind of the core truths that I think that on some level we will philosophically and existentially embrace if we are people of God. And so that's the sense in which I'm talking about the central piece, the central role of truth in understanding biblical faith. It's kind of where belief comes in, because as Larry talked about last week in his talk on evil, we have hearts that have been darkened, and we have hearts that don't respond to truth on our own. And so my contention here tonight is that God, in fact, the evidence of God's Spirit at work in our heart is our receptivity to the truth. And that can be, again, truth about who He is, about information about God and His reality, accepting reality, as well as truth about ourselves and where we have failed. Certainly the central core truth that I think is kind of a litmus test of belief is our response to the information that we are broken, sinful people. And that is a truth that does not come easily to any of us. And so I would say that accepting that truth is what is a really solid indicator that the Spirit of God has invaded our lives, because left to ourselves, we won't go there. Okay. So the first passage I want to look at is John 18. And it's where Pilate says his famous question about what is truth. I just want to read a couple of verses, 37 and 38. Pilate therefore said to him, "So you are a king?" Jesus answered, "You say correctly that I am a king. For this I have been born, and for this I have come into the world, to bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice." Pilate said to him, "What is truth?" This is a place where Jesus says, claims that everyone who is of the truth hears my voice. So he's saying that those who understand what he's saying and hear his voice have been attuned to that. They are of the truth. Pilate's question, I think, indicates his rejection of that on a pretty core level, because his question is motivated by not wanting to embrace what Jesus just said. It could be that he went away and thought about it and believed. Who knows? We don't know. But I think left with just this information, it looks more like, to me, the process of the question is, I'm not going there, and I'm going to throw a question in your face. And then he goes on, he kind of wants to avoid the conflict and says, okay, you guys, I don't find any fault in him. I'm going to see if you guys want to release somebody, because that's your custom. And to his surprise, perhaps to his surprise, some people think they decided to release Barabbas instead of Jesus. But I think Pilate was kind of in a sticky wicket there and trying to get out of it. But I think this is a place where Jesus is pointing him to this reality, that those who are of the truth hear his voice. So the next passage I wanted to look at is in John 16. And I'm going to read verses 12 through 16. The whole chapter is very pertinent, but I'm just going to read 12 through 15, actually. I have many more things. This is Jesus talking to his disciples. "I have many more things to say to you, but you cannot bear them now. But when he, the Spirit of truth, comes, he will guide you into all the truth. For he will not speak on his own initiative, but whatever he hears, he will speak, and he will disclose to you what is to come. He shall glorify me, for he shall take of mine and shall disclose it to you. All things that the Father has are mine. Therefore I said that he takes of mine and will disclose it to you." Now, some of you have heard Jack talk a little bit about the idea of the Spirit of truth being this, the Greek word there is parakletos, and earlier in this passage it's translated helper. A better translation might be persuader or revealer. And so he's saying that he is going to send another helper, another persuader, which is the Spirit of truth. And then he says, "When he, the Spirit of truth, comes, he will guide you into all the truth. For he will speak on his own initiative. He will not speak on his own initiative, but whatever he hears, he will speak. And he will disclose to you what is to come." I'm going to talk a little bit more about that in a second, about the idea of the role of the Spirit of truth. He talks about sending another advocate. And I think in the passage we're about to look at, you'll see that Jesus is claiming that he's the first one. So God the Father has sent Jesus. Jesus is now saying the Spirit of truth is going to come next and reveal what Jesus has taught, which is what the Father has revealed to him. So that's kind of the context of what Jesus is saying there. So the main passage I want to look at, though, is in John 8. And I'm going to read a lengthy passage here. I'm going to read verses 31 through 47. And the context of this is Jesus has just talked to his disciples at the Mount of Olives, and he's talked about being the light of the world and kind of who he is and what he's doing here. And some of the Jews who have been listening start to disagree with him or start to challenge him on some things. And so, and it says also that many came to believe in him at this time, too. So they weren't all his disciples. There were a lot of people there. So starting in verse 31, Jesus therefore was saying to those Jews who had believed him, "If you abide in my word, then you are truly disciples of mine, and you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." They answered him, "We are Abraham's offspring and have never yet been enslaved to anyone. How is it that you say you shall become free?" Jesus answered them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, everyone who commits sin is the slave of sin. And the slave does not remain in the house forever. The son does remain forever. If therefore the son shall make you free, you shall be free indeed. I know that you are Abraham's offspring, yet you seek to kill me, because my word has no place in you. I speak the things which I have seen with my father. Therefore you also do the things which you heard from your father." They answered and said to him, "Abraham is our father." Jesus said to them, "If you are Abraham's children, do the deeds of Abraham. But as it is, you are seeking to kill me, a man who has told you the truth, which I heard from God. This Abraham did not do. You are doing the deeds of your father." They said to him, "We were not born of fornication. We have one father, even God." Jesus said to them, "If God were your father, you would love me. For I proceeded forth and have come from God. For I have not even come on my own initiative, but he sent me. Why do you not understand what I am saying? It is because you cannot hear my word. You are of your father the devil, and you want to do the desires of your father. He was a murderer from the beginning and does not stand in the truth, because there is no truth in him. Whenever he speaks a lie, he speaks from his own nature, for he is a liar and the father of lies. But because I speak the truth, you do not believe me. Which one of you convicts me of sin? If I speak truth, why do you not believe me? He who is of God hears the words of God. For this reason you do not hear them, because you are not of God." I was really struck with that last verse. I mean, that's pretty clear. He's saying right there, why do you not hear my words? Because you're not God's. They're blind. They're blind to what he's saying. And there were several set pieces of that passage which struck me that way. If you abide in my word, then you are truly my disciples, and you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. He's talking about slavery to sin in the context here. He goes on to say, they say they haven't ever been imprisoned, and he says anyone who has sinned is a prisoner. And so that's the freedom that he's really speaking about, is understanding the truth of the gospel and being free from sin. My word has no place in you. It can also be read, my word makes no progress in you. And I think that might be a more clear reading. If God were your father, you would love me. Why do you not understand? Because you cannot hear. The reason you don't hear is that you don't belong to God. So, my conclusion from the reading of this passage is that if we are God's, we will eventually be willing to stand naked and exposed in the light and let things be revealed. And in particular, things about ourselves and our own motivations and our own sinfulness. So, that's where I think the core issue of how we respond to truth reflects the working of God's Spirit in us. I just read a book by Os Guinness called Time for Truth, and in it he says a quote that if many of you have read the News and Views article that I just wrote, I quoted him in that, but I really like this quote. As human beings, we are by nature truth seekers. We're hardwired that way. He says, but as fallen human beings, we are also by nature truth twisters. And he cites Aldous Huxley in Ends and Means. Huxley actually admits to having motivations for believing what he believes. And so this is the sense that I'm trying to get at, is when we either receive or don't receive what's true or resist what's true, philosophically as well as experientially or existentially, it's because we have a prior commitment. It's because we have a will that has already decided whether or not we're going to go there. And so our will precedes what we decide we're going to believe. So it can look like we're believing certain things, but when we hit a critical juncture and we're forced to reevaluate, or we're forced to look at ourselves and say we were wrong about something, that's where it can show up, that our motivation might have been less than pure for seeking the truth. I just want to read this quote by Huxley. I had motives for not wanting the world to have meaning, consequently assumed that it had none, and was able without any difficulty to find satisfying reasons for this assumption. It is our will that decides how and upon what subjects we shall use our intelligence. So I think that's pretty interesting admission, especially for someone who is clearly committed to being an atheist. So our receptivity to embracing truth when it confronts us is an issue actually of our heart, not really of our mind. It's an issue of the will. So truth makes sense. The way reality works is that it makes sense. The data fits together in God's reality. And if we're not willing to have our paradigms shifted to understanding that reality, then we have to keep rationalizing the lie. And so we actually get further and further away from reality and from truth as we go into that process. And I think that as God's Spirit works in us, it can be a long process. I don't think it's about having the right things on a doctrinal statement, but it's more about having an openness to moving toward what's true as we progress toward throughout our lives. Yeah, so I really related to that quote by Huxley because in my college days, many of you know, you guys know the story that when I was in college, I converted to atheism after being a Christian for a number of years. And part of it was a lot of disillusionment with the Christian culture that I was in and things that weren't fitting and things that I didn't really like about that. And when I decided that the atheists were actually more honest in their seeking, I went about claiming to be more honest in pursuing atheism, and I did that for a number of years. And yet, as I look back on that, I really understand what he's saying there, because it had so much less to do. I framed it at the time as an intellectual decision, but it had so much more to do with I didn't like what was being asked of me by God. I didn't like what he was doing in my life. He had said no to me in a really big way. And to be honest, I didn't like that. No. And so rather than really even knowing that, I didn't even know that for years later, but I instead translated into this intellectual decision that Christianity didn't make sense, it didn't work, and this made more sense. And so I went down that road. And looking back on it, I really see the complexities and the intricacies of how my rebellion turned into this so-called intellectual rejection of Christianity. What was really at stake was that I didn't like the reality that God was asking me to live in. And I was saying no to that. And I was using intellectual grounds to do that. But it had very little to do with intellectual arguments when it really got right down to it. So, and I've also seen this happen for people who, you know, you talk about Christianity making sense, and I think around here especially we talk about that a lot. I'm very committed to the idea that the reason to believe Christianity is because it's true, and that that's the only good reason to believe. And yet I think this other issue of where our hearts predispose us to accepting what's true is a really big deal, because if someone is committed to a particular viewpoint or a particular worldview, then no amount of debating or discussing is going to get anywhere with them, as it wouldn't have with me, as it wouldn't have with any of us before God's Spirit worked to soften and till the soil in our hearts. And so I think that that's the way in which the truth is a central feature in the life of faith. So I'm going to now talk amongst the panel and just discuss some of these ideas. And I'm going to move the podium and sit with them. And then in about another 20 or 30 minutes, we'll open it up for discussion. So the question that I was left with at the end, I was just going to throw out here for us, was Jesus' discussion in John 8 about the reason we don't hear it, the reason they didn't hear it was because they don't belong to God. I wonder if we could bring that into our kind of historical context in our lives and just kind of throw out the question of what does that look like for us?
The reason we don't hear?
Yeah, in general, just people, us, what it looks like, whether we do hear or no. Does that make sense?
I think we're resistors.
But that's the reason?
Yeah, I think there's so many different ways this issue of the role, how we relate to what is true, or what is, how we personally respond to facts or perspectives that become clear to us at a particular moment that it's true, relating to this subject that Jesus is getting at regarding who are we, what are we about, where are we going? I mean, what is our identity? What is our significance? What is our the ground of our existence? All those kinds of issues have to do ultimately and very critically with what kind of creature am I today? And the biblical picture is that I'm a broken, rebellious creature that results in the evil of me resisting and suppressing what is true rather than automatically embracing what is true. So, I mean, this is really critical.
So our first response to truth is really to push it down, to hold it back, to resist it.
I think that's one of the most amazing and disturbing facts about us, and one of the most miraculous elements of becoming a believer in Christ's gospel is that we actually turn around and embrace that fact. Yeah. That we're really not interested in the truth.
I think that's an amazing thing too, because on some level we've all heard the gospel, we've all been told that we're sinners. And yeah, we can sort of accept that theoretically, or we are told that's what we're supposed to believe. But when it gets down to in my life every day and somebody interacting with me and telling me that I've screwed up or that I've hurt them or something like that, that's tough. I mean, I think you're right. Our first response is to defend, mm-hmm. to deflect, to do the kinds of stuff that Adam and Eve did that I talked about last week. But it's not like we can point the finger at them and say, I don't do that,
right?
Because it's exactly what we do.
Right. And that's why the issue of the role of truth in believing is so not theoretical, but very critically personal.
Yeah.
And directly related to the process of our being saved.
Yes. Yeah.
It occurred to me that, see what you guys think about this idea. it occurred to me in thinking about this that if we believe the gospel, the big, grand, amazing picture that God presents in the scriptures, the pictures we draw from the scriptures about who we are and what we were, what kind of creatures we are, and where we came from, and why God made us, and then we dial in the picture, the hope of the gospel, and a destiny that God is promising us because of Christ's work. That glorious destiny, that we are creatures who were made for truth, and that we violate our very nature. Ultimately, we violate the purpose for the one of the central purposes for which we exist or we were created. That's how warped and twisted the effects of evil are on our lives. That the corruption that has occurred because of the condition of our hearts is such that it's ignorant and resists the picture that God has for us in the most fundamentally insane way. And the fact of the matter is, we actually, even in our believing, in our daily existential experience, continue to imbibe of that rebellion. And that's really tough.
It's pretty scary. I mean, it's frightening because it seems to me that it's the most natural thing for us to do, number one. And it shows me that I indeed need to be saved. I mean, I'm in trouble.
It's so pervasive, it's so subtle, and it's so deeply set inside of us.
Yeah. I think that's right. I think that's what Guinness is getting at in this quote. As human beings, we are by nature truth seekers. As fallen beings, we are also by nature truth twisters. And I think I've talked about, in terms of the model I present about relationships, is that we are created in God's image, and part of that is that we are rational beings. We have this amazing gift to process information on a variety of levels simultaneously, to draw conclusions, to know stuff. So we have this, God has hardwired into us this sort of need to know, this desire to understand and to know truth, and especially to know Him, and that He's made Himself knowable, and then we said, we're out of here, we don't want it. Mm-hmm. And He said, okay, you don't get it.
Yeah.
Cut us off.
Yeah.
And the fact that He cut us off is, it's not just the fact that I said this last week, it's not just the fact that we sin when we want to, it's like we're out of control.
Yeah.
And it's the God Himself, the sovereign, transcendent creator of the universe, that's cut us off. Mm-hmm. So it's not like you and I going on each other. Mm-hmm. It's like God, we're taking on God here. God is the one who's set the sentence here. So it's a pretty serious thing.
We're really cut off. Being able to find what's true or do what's right.
Well, there's that section in Romans 1 that talks about the actual suppression of the truth, that we become creatures who are fundamentally so corrupted that we resist the truth and actually see the truth and suppress it. Mm-hmm. And I was reading through John again a little bit tonight, sections of John, and I was looking at how often in John he points to and refers to the miracles of Jesus as signs. What were they signs for? They were signs given to validate the truth of Jesus' identity as Messiah and His mission and His message. They were signs. And I was thinking about how literally insane it was, and how literally incredible it was that in the case, for example, of the man who was blind for 30 years and then was made to see by Jesus, who gets brought in before the religious leaders, and they grill him on, "You weren't really blind from birth, were you?" And he just grilled this guy, and he says, "You know, I don't get it. You know, I don't know about this guy who did this, but I know I was blind and now I can see." And we all know that God, in their theology, God doesn't bless someone or give someone the power to do the things that Jesus was doing, because no one historically had ever done that before, unless God is with him. So the guy actually turned around, turned the tables on them and said, "You know, wake up, open your eyes." Well, but the thing that I was noticing was how, I can't find another word, how insane it was for them to be able to look at the evidence, the sign of who Jesus was and his message, and to reject it in the face of that kind of miracle.
They had to work really hard. They had to work really
hard. It's interesting. It's interesting, on a physical level, Jesus opened this guy's eyes. He was blind.
Mm-hmm. Such a metaphor.
Exactly. I mean, it's sort of, on the other hand, you've got these Pharisees over here, or these religious people who are supposed to be the protectors of the truth, who don't see it, who are really blind. So what an irony.
What do you think is the parallel? What do you think is the parallel for? I mean, there is a parallel here, because we're like they are, mm-hmm. in the patterns of our resistance.
Sure.
But how do you think about that in terms of actually being a believer? Mm-hmm. Who embraces the gospel at one profound level, yeah. but and on a daily existential level, we struggle with it. We still struggle with it.
We resist it.
Yeah. How do you put that together? That is, the fact that we believe the gospel on the one hand, but we still struggle with the truth.
I'm not sure I understand your question exactly of how you put it together. It makes sense to me, because it fits what the Bible says is true on one level. I mean, as I read the scriptures, it describes me. It describes my experience of being blind and being a resistor. On the other hand, it describes my experience of what kind of the passages that Nancy was reading tonight about, if you hear God's voice, it's because you belong to him, or mm-hmm. that kind of thing. And so when I have these experiences or moments where God reveals truth to me about myself that's painful or hard to see, I have both those experiences. Mm-hmm. And I keep, in moments of clarity, I keep wanting to know the truth about myself. Mm-hmm. And
I guess I'm wondering if that's normal.
I think it is very normal.
I guess maybe you could talk about that. Why is that normal? I mean, how is it normal? I mean, in the sense of, there's a lot of theology out there that says once you believe, there ought to be some kind of...
Well, there's the whole victorious Christian life thing that uses 2 Corinthians 5:17, that we're all new creatures in Christ, blah, 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 blah. That somehow sin isn't an issue, evil isn't an issue anymore. I think that verse is taken completely out of context to use that verse that way, because that's not what Paul is talking about. He's really talking about what his experience was in his own conversion. And basically he was saying that he's in a process of God opening his eyes and helping him see, and he's in a process of God changing his heart and changing the desires of his heart. He's not saying that he's arrived by any stretch of the imagination. He's just saying once he was blind before, and now he's beginning to see. Mm-hmm. Or once he wanted the wrong things, and now he's beginning mm-hmm. to want the right things, which correlates to what Paul says in Romans 1 when he talks about God's wrath of God handing us over to the custody of being people who want the wrong things and who think wrong. So there's some coherence there. Mm-hmm. So I see myself and Christians as very much in a process of being transformed. From being people who don't want truth, who don't think right, who don't judge right, and who don't want the right things, to be people who are slowly transformed, to be people who want truth, who struggle with it, in the process struggle with it, but who want the right things. And I don't I don't think I'm going to get there until till eternity. But I think one of the things that happens that Nancy was talking about in terms of the Spirit of God working in our lives is that I have the desire to want to know what's true. I want it. And I want to want it sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's part of the issue, is that sometimes it boils down. I was mulling this over and sort of doing a little self-examination and the phenomenon of my own experience, and realizing that there are times when it boils down, we're actually shocked by our own resistance.
Yeah.
And shocked in a very fundamental way, in a way that jars us down to the core.
Very profound way,
Our resistance or our blindness when something is revealed that we just did not see at all.
It's pretty... go ahead.
And it all of a sudden is clear, and it's shocking that we didn't see it sooner.
I get to see this all the time in counseling, and you can see the sort of the effects of living in a postmodern world, and postmodernism for me, from my perspective, is just another form of resistance to the truth. I mean, it's just a way we do it, or it's a label that we have for doing it in our culture in this 21st century, but. As a therapist, there's a lot of pressure in our profession to make people feel good. It used to be that the mental health profession defined mental health as a person's ability to function in reality. That was 20 years ago, 25 years ago. But slowly there's been this transition over the last 20 years, and now the purpose of counseling, or the definition of mental health, is how a person experiences themselves, how they feel. That's a very different shift. And so the way that it plays out is there's a lot of pressure on therapists to make people feel good. And rather than facing them into the choices that they're making, or why they're making the choices, or the beliefs they have behind their choices, or taking responsibility for their choices, or in fact what their choice, or what even motivates their choices, which isn't fun. It's very, very difficult. People just get completely surprised that it's possible that they could be that sinful or that evil.
Could both of you, or either of you, talk about in your, for example, both of you are counselors, so you see this all the time. How does reality force the truth on us? And does that align itself with the Bible?
Yeah. I see it in all of us, number one. I don't just see it in the people that I work with, but I see it in myself. And that is that one of the ways in which we hide from the truth is that we try to hide from the consequences of our own choices. And yet as we hide from the consequences of our own choices, there's consequences to that. And we keep smacking into reality. And at some point, we hit the wall of... It just hits us in the face, and we finally see it. I think if God uses that, can use that process of our hitting the wall of reality, of keeping avoid the consequences, keeping avoid that, and finally just smacking into it, I think that's one of the profound tools of God.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's how He created reality.
That's how He created reality.
Yeah, and the way that. That our choices have consequences, and how they play out, and how they force us to be, to look at reality, or else reject it and rationalize and get more.
Yeah.
You know, there's another example that I came across this week of the one that you mentioned about, hey, all I know is I was blind, now I can see, and how hard they had to work at figuring out a different explanation. In Matthew, the passage where... where Jesus casts a demon out and they attribute it to Satan. This is another really clear example of this, that he is just, I forget, he has performed a miracle. I think it's either the feeding of the 5,000 or one of those, one of the miracles preceded that whole exchange. And then this demon-possessed guy shows up, and then, and Jesus casts the demon out. And then the Pharisees who are standing there say, he casts demons out by the prince of demons. And Jesus' response to that is, I don't think that's a good explanation for what just happened here. You know, I mean, it's kind of, if you read kind of between the lines, the process of what's happening is Jesus is saying, a house divided against itself can't stand. I mean, why would I do that?
Yeah.
If, you know, that's really not a good explanation.
It doesn't make sense.
It doesn't make sense. And then they come back to him and say, give us a sign. And it's like you're reading this and I'm thinking,
that's when he says, you evil generation, isn't it?
Yes, and he says, the only sign you will be given is the sign of Jonah. Then he has this kind of obscure passage about, and I talked to Jack a little bit about this, it was interesting. I've never had any kind of explanation for this passage, the one where he gives the example of the demons going out and going to the faraway places and then coming back and finding the house in order and seven more join them.
Yeah.
He was saying that his idea is that is this example of Jesus saying, I'm not going to give you a sign because you've had an opportunity to believe here. And if I give you another sign and you reject it too, you're that much further down the road of that much more dug in.
Resistant to truth.
Yeah, that much more dug in.
Wow.
That you're seven times more a son of hell than the first time around. I mean, that's kind of what he's saying there.
Yikes.
And it's really powerful.
Wow.
But that's another example of how they just weren't getting it. And I think that's so powerful.
Yeah.
What an example.
So here we have two, I mean, we could talk about this at two different levels and lots of levels in between, I suppose. But on the one hand, I'm profoundly touched by the fact that the biblical fact that my very nature, my identity, the nature of my being in existence is such that, and all those theological, philosophical, and metaphysical kinds of statements and descriptions, that I am about my whole, that at the very core of my nature, I am a being, I am a creature created to live in and be of the truth. And that's the nature of my salvation is a process and a progression from this moment to the resurrection of becoming a creature like that. So at that theological and biblical level, that's what I'm about. That's the very core issue of what I'm about. At this other existential, personal, day-to-day level, I have this incredible battle and struggle going on about whether every day I want to be a person of truth, whether I want to embrace that fact in a personal, in a very personal way.
Right.
And so the role of truth in my believing is central. The role that my perspective and my,
it's like how I interact with truth as it faces me each day,
right.
as I am confronted with it each
and
day.
And that also leads another, there's another rabbit trail thought here, and that is that we really need each other. That truth, because of the nature of our brokenness, our fallenness, and our the very nature of our weakness and our ignorance, that's all tied up in the corruption of at the very core of our lives, we need each other. And that's, I think, talks a lot about, a great deal about, being together as believers. And the letters, if you read the New Testament letters, they talk often about reminding each other, about reminding each other of the gospel. That is, if you stop and think about it, the nature of the New Testament letters themselves are that they are letters of reminder, which by implication means that part of our corruption and failure is that we're forgetters. We are forgetters. And we desperately need each other, and the fellowship that we get at the very core of our fellowship should be this commitment.
I think about Paul's prayers too. A lot of his prayers are praying that we would see the truth, that we'd be enlightened.
Yeah. Right.
That the eyes of our heart would be
exactly.
Open.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that really
That's how he prays for the churches.
Yeah. And that really shows his understanding of how deep our problem is.
Exactly.
Of how much we don't go there.
Yes.
If I'm hearing you right, you're saying that there's this one sense in which we believe things. We have this stuff that we believe. We have our philosophy in place and our Christianity or our worldview or whatever. But then on this other level, our lives confront us with what decisions we're going to make in the light of what we believe, and whether or not whether or not we're going to ultimately accept who we really are in the midst of those choices and work with that. And that's where our relationships with each other really come in to play, is in helping us see better, helping us remember, helping us... we really need help. I know that, we laugh sometimes about how much better I can see what you do wrong than I can see what I do wrong. And yet it's really true. I mean, I can see out there pretty well sometimes, I think. But then, I put the mirror on, and it's like, whoa, I don't want to see that. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't come naturally. It's like, part of it is that I'm just so in it. I can't see out because it's just kind of where I am all the time.
That's very uncomfortable.
And it's very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
So I think that's part of how we can really help each other is by opening ourselves up to those kind of relationships that can actually honestly confront us with who we are on that level.
Yeah.
And what we don't see well. Is this a good time to open it up?
Sure.
For discussion?
Sure.
Okay.
Go girl.
Could you click it on Leah will bring the microphone. Christy?
On the one hand, you have Paul, who says, if anyone teaches anything differently than I do, or if anyone doesn't believe the message that I preach, then they're opposed to the truth. He just makes that declarative statement. That's the way it is. It's a matter of fact. So, on the other hand, you have, for example, yourselves, who are pursuers of the truth, and in a sense, teachers of the truth, just like Paul. So, to what extent do you carry that same authority? I mean, if truth is divisive, you land on one side or the other. And so, when you find people reacting to your teaching in one way or the other, how do you take that? I mean, do you say, if they disagree with me, I know that I'm preaching the truth, so they're accursed? Mm-hmm. Or do you say, God is bringing them along? Or how do you deal with that?
That's what I say. They're just wrong.
We should talk.
No, that's a really good question, actually. I would answer that by saying that I think Paul's authority is the real authority, because he was an apostle and he had been granted a very specific and special authority of bringing the gospel from Jesus himself to that first generation. So to the extent to which we might understand what his gospel is, we might be on to the truth. But I don't think we've been granted a similar authority. So authority-wise, I would say we don't have much. I think his gospel has the authority, and as we understand what he was saying, I think we can assert an understanding of what's true about what he was saying was true. And of course, there's a lot that goes into that, like authorial intent and cultural context and language and context and coherence and all those things that we talk a lot about around here. Did that sort of answer your question? Oh, truth being divisive, that was another piece of it, that if somebody doesn't react well to what I say is true, I don't really have a conclusion to make about that, other than because it could be that I didn't say it well. It could be that they're in process and they're going to grapple with it, and they're going to come back a month later and go, I would have never believed it then, or a year later or whatever. So I think there is a lot of room for people to be in process, and there's a lot of room for us as teachers to sometimes not say it well. What else would you add to that?
I think that's true, but I also think probably in the 20 years that I've been doing this, I've run into probably half a dozen people who I would say were evil, like the couple that we talked about last week, and who were just
given over to
evil.
Mm-hmm. And we're not going to
right,
go there.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I haven't been doing it as long as Larry.
Sorry.
Because I'm younger.
Much.
Anyway, but I have run into that too, but it's been rare that I would say that I could really see that or sense it or something.
But I guess more basically what I'm asking is that there's truth in the abstract, and then there's truth as we live it or don't live it, and see it or don't see it every day. So, I mean, how do we respond to the manifestation of that in reality in other people's lives, like as far as accountability and things like that are concerned?
With humility.
Sure.
I mean, I really think everybody's in the same boat, and it seems to me that the degree to which we really do have a level of fundamental understanding and right understanding of the gospel, that we can be certain about that understanding of the gospel, and we can check that certainty by reasonable, commonsensical methods in looking at what the Bible is saying, so that they're verifiable in that sense. So that we're not just saying, well, this is what I believe because it seems to me the right thing and feels good to me. So
it's not really that abstract.
But still, I mean, someone can assert that they think they know what's the truth of a situation, and they might be right, but as has already been said, because we know we come by the truth over a struggle and a process, we know that they're coming to the truth through a struggle and a process, and you know, depending on the issue, we have to say, well, this is my understanding right now, and I think this is right, this is where I stand right now, but I want to stay open to what's true, and I might be wrong. So with that measure of humility, it seems that to me that engenders pursuit of what's true rather than the conflict necessarily that you might be implying.
It's not like there's not truth we need to hear too. And I think, especially in the helping professions, that there is an easy trap to start to think about sort of you're there to help people, so it's kind of a me and them feeling or perspective that subtly distorts. And I think it's very easy to remember, like what Wes is talking about, is that the moral playing field is level here, and it's very important to remember that. And even in the helping profession, I think it's important to understand that that the work that if God may be using me to help people or to help them see or whatever, to bring some healing, that's a really good thing. But that doesn't exclude me from God using that person in my life or doing something in my life or helping me see something or confronting me with something. So what God wants to do in my life is just as real, just as present as anything I might think I'm doing in somebody else's life. And I think that's really important to keep in perspective.
And along those lines, I think listening is a really great tool, because what it can also show me is where the struggle is for this person. So where they might say, well, I don't agree with you on that, well, I might not yet understand what exactly they're disagreeing with, because it might be the way I said it, it might be an issue that they have with something that doesn't have anything to do with what I just said, but if I can listen to them, I have a better shot at really joining in their understanding of reality and working in that context to move us both closer to the truth. Does that make sense? Okay.
Logan.
I'm just wondering if willingness to believe the truth is a global attribute, a personal characteristic that should affect every area of your life. The reason I ask this is because some truth is heavier than other. Okay, it has more implications. There are people out there who will probably fight to the death to prove that 2 + 2 = 4. And they won't accept any other answer, and they will hang their integrity on their willingness in their profession or their science or whatever to, you know, believe what the facts say. But when you hand them, granted it's a different language, but when you hand them a statement by Jesus which says, you need to be redeemed, suddenly the wall goes right up. It's like, sure, 2 + 2 = 4, and someone got to the moon first, and all these facts they will embrace because it's the truth. And they'll rewrite their own books if they get new information to show that, oh my gosh, what I said wasn't true. Got to fix that. But this one, absolutely, there is an animosity to it that is just inexplicable.
Well, I think that's what Jesus says, that he's the stumbling block. Because if you have to, you confront him and what he's about, then you have to face into the fact that he's saying that he was the sacrifice for our sin. And that's the big stumbling block.
We're also going to spend some time next week talking about non-ultimate truth and kind of objective versus subjective and some of that. So we might address that a little bit further next time as well.
Yeah, I was just going to say that I think we'll be covered more next week. It does occur to me that there's truth, like you said, there's truth and there's truth. There's the, you know, the truth of how grasshopper legs work, and then there's the truth of whether I am a creature made by a God who is there, who is good, and for whom it is good and righteous that I be good. That moral dimension, when the moral dimension, the ethical and the moral dimension meets the fact, then any fact can become a moral issue. For example, grasshopper legs in my scientific journal, I'm writing an article and, you know, I come across some information that somebody else has that proves that my research is wrong. But I'm right on the cusp of being published, and I have the power to suppress that information. All of a sudden, the moral dimension impinges on the factual, scientific dimension. And so those dimensions are always floating. They're never,
separate.
They're inextricably woven together, but they are separately identifiable. So it seems to me that, as Nancy mentioned, next week, that can be explored a bit, and that Emil Brunner, the German theologian, who came up with a term that I can't remember, he had a theological term that he coined about this principle that he argued was a biblical principle, that the closer an issue was to, the closer it got to man's moral condition, to his moral nature, the more resistance the human soul, the fallen human soul, put up against the issue. So if it's floating around out here and it's, you're talking about mathematics and, you know, there's not a lot of resistance, but the closer you get to the core, which is what Jesus' message was all about and why he called what he said the truth, the closer it gets, the more dissonance and the more resistance and the more rebellion and the more energy there is to resist that truth.
Anybody resist truth lately? Any of you guys? Show of hands. Good. Anybody else? Questions?
You had to ask
topics?
A question.
Basically, I guess what I wanted to say is that I have a friend who has been my best friend for like 12 years, and about 10 years ago, she just kind of said something to me off the cuff, and as we were talking about God and relationship and all of that, and she says, well, she was kind of rationalizing some decisions that she had made, and she said, well, I'm here and God's kind of just out there. He's a part of my life, but he's not the whole thing. And I think when you were talking about, you know, we have our whole idea of philosophy and all that up here, it's kind of separate. And about 10 years later, within this last year, she said to me something that was completely opposite of that. And I just, my heart just leapt for her because she had finally gotten to the point where God's here, you know. So I just kind of wanted to share that because it came up when you said that. So.
Yeah.
That's a great, yeah. So it's like you could see and you saw that process for her where she was not there 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And it took 10 years, but God slowly brought her to knowing that. It's really cool.
Just another comment that I've come to know just recently, that I cannot back down from the truth, and I cannot let someone else come at me and say something that isn't true about the Lord and just back down and let them have their way. You have to stand up for the truth. That's what I've come to learn. So, I mean, you can be humble and everything, but when there's a basic truth there, it's very important as a Christian not to back down.
If it really becomes clear that we are committed to really different pictures.
Right.
We need to say, I think we're committed to really different pictures here, and say what we think is true. Is that kind of what you're saying?
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you know, mm-hmm. as a Christian person, a believer in the gospel and what Jesus does and says, it's coming to a point where you're going to stand or you're not going to, you know, and in this world, so stand up.
Yeah. Reminds me of that. I can quote St. Bobby Dylan at that point. You got to serve somebody. It may be the devil or it may be the Lord. You're going to have to serve somebody. It's a great song.
I guess by way of a kind of concluding remark from me, it seems to me that another thing that John is pointing out in the gospel, in his gospel, is making it really clear that the idea of being a person of truth, a man or a woman of the truth, is equal to being a believer in the message of the gospel. Normally, we wouldn't necessarily automatically put those things together. But I think that's exactly what happens when you really think about it, when you start putting some things together and looking at, especially I think at John's gospel, where he has this perspective of many, many years. He's an old man when he writes this gospel, and he sees all these connections with a lot of reflection and a lot of a lot of history in his lifetime. And to be a person who loves the truth, who wants to embrace the truth, is critical and central to the issue of being a believer in Jesus. And that doesn't mean that being a believer means that automatically and instantaneously you're going to embrace the truth every time. You, as a believer, you will find yourself struggling with the truth. But ultimately, and often we end up saying, I'm a person who loves the truth even though I struggle with the courage to fully embrace the implications of the truth. God help me.
It's kind of my one-to-one-to thing.
Yeah.
And I think it gets clearer as we go on how poorly we do with that. I don't know. I mean, I think about Paul saying toward the end of his life that he was the chief of sinners, and I just don't think that's a coincidence. I think it's because he got it more deeply than he did in the beginning of his life.
You don't think he's just being politically correct?
Yeah. I don't think so.
I don't either.
I think it's
theologically correct.
Yeah, I think it's really significant. Yeah. Oh, you know, and that was another thing I was going to say when you had your comment about our theology, and we say we're sinners, and that's like part of the deal. That's number two,
the
right?
mantra.
Isn't that like spiritual law number two or something?
Yeah.
And yet, I think we're really encouraged to redefine sin so that we can say we don't do that anymore.
Yeah.
Because once we get converted, we don't do all those awful things that we might have used to do. Or, but it's so, that's so deceptive.
Yeah.
Because it helps us not see the ways we do reject reality and resist truth and hurt each other by doing that.
Yeah, it's like, you know, Adam and Eve, when they first ate the fruit, they experienced guilt. And so they responded to that by hiding, by making this feeble attempt to cover themselves because they felt, or they felt exposed, and embarrassed and ashamed. So that was the first decision. Okay, the second decision is they hear God in the garden, and they hide from Him. Okay, and then the next decision is He says, "What's the deal? What happened?" And Adam goes. And then Eve goes, so it's like this series of decisions they made to hide from the consequences of their own choices. And there we are.
That's
real life. That's not just this theological discussion that we're having up in the space.
Yeah.
That's real life. That happened.
Yeah.
And that's what we do.
That's what I want to really make clear is that I really want to say that that's what we do. I mean, the thing that we get better is how much we need saving, because we see that reality in our own lives.
You know, we can go to places.
How much we hide from what the truth is. And from the,
you know, they were going from feeling embarrassed and exposed to finding a place of comfort for themselves by covering themselves. Well, we go to places of comfort all the time.
Absolutely.
And they hid. And they blamed and deflected, and we do that all the time. So it's like real life.
And I really think that those are things about us that aren't going to be fixed here. Those are things that aren't going to be fixed until the kingdom.
Right.
And the difference is that the Spirit of Truth gives us eyes to see how bad off we really are.
Absolutely.
And how much we need the gospel. Keith.
What do you think the emotional appeal of the victorious Christian movement is to people? What makes it attractive?
What makes Christianity attractive?
Victorious Christian living.
I think the idea that we can do it. The idea that righteousness and goodness is obtainable. And that it's measurable, tangible, and I can accomplish it. I think that's very, and I can do it and feel good about myself, call myself good, all that.
Control?
Sure.
That's what I was going to say. I think there's a lot of control in it, too, because I don't have to know how vulnerable I am in the universe before God. In terms of how my life can go, I can kind of decide that if I do certain things, then I'm guaranteed a certain quality of spiritual victory or peace and well-being in this life.
Yeah, instead of, I think that's really what Nancy's saying is important. It's like, I don't have to experience myself as vulnerable. I can actually be autonomous and spiritualize it and feel good about it. And I have that control of what my experience is. I think that's the seduction of it.
It's been around for a long time. A really good book that's probably out of print now, you might find it somewhere, it's an old classic by Benjamin Warfield called Perfectionism. If you have a real interest in the theological, some really great theological background on the whole notion, and it's, he wrote the book at the right at the end of the 19th century, coming into the 20th century, having lived through a time when the evangelical culture was under a lot of stress, and in the wake of the First Awakening and the Second Awakening in the 19th century. But I think there's another factor along with what Larry and Nancy were saying, which I think is really true. Ultimately, these are the big issues, I think. Another reason why it does so well is the nature of our American culture. That we have a very can-do, or we ought to be able to do, pull yourselves up by your own bootstraps kind of culture. Right.
Self-sufficiency.
Yeah, and you, when you fix that kind of mentality and sort of national persona and ethos into what even in the late 20th century has become a kind of technological can-do. It's an even greater and more insidious form of sort of mechanistic control of reality.
Yes.
Sort of scientific management. So you can, scientific management can manage all of life and all of reality, including making one's existence truly spiritual by taking certain sound bites out of the Bible and making them into a package that sounds like it's going to be victorious. The problem is, ultimately, it doesn't work. So you end up being a real liar to yourself, I think, when you try to force what you're really experiencing into what really is a false teaching.
I think it becomes one of those situations like we were talking about where you have to work really hard to make it work. And it's,
To suppress the truth.
It's like, wait, all I know is I was blind, now I can see. I mean, it's the same kind of thing. It's like, there's a better explanation. There's one that you don't have to work so hard at. And I think those are the explanations that we need to go for, because I think there really is a principle of that's how reality works smoothly. I don't think you have to force it. And that's evidence. Anyone else?
Yeah.
Parting thoughts?
Who is that up?
Benjamin Warfield. He's one of the starters of Princeton Seminary.
You guys said that everyone resists truth to a certain degree. I was wondering if Christians resist it in the same way, or if it's just kind of like they're not ready to hear it, they're not mature enough, if they haven't built the layers, you know, the foundation to learn the higher truth, or if it's just the same, I don't want to hear it.
Yeah, I think that's really the key difference, is I think that if the Spirit of God is at work in our hearts, He will be revealing, persuading us of what the truth actually is. I think we still resist it. Our first hit is the resistance. But our resistance breaks down if we're God's. And so in time and in this process, we will agree with Him and finally give up. and say, okay, yeah, that's what's true. Where someone who is not of God, I think, is it's going to be dug in a different way and continue in that resistance.
Seems to me that being a Christian, being a believer, a real believer, has at its very core a kind of commitment to the truth, even though the person may be immature and maybe they haven't articulated it to themselves very well or very completely. It may be immature in that sense, but the seed of being a person of truth is there if there's a genuine work of the Spirit of God at the core of their lives, bringing them to their salvation. So again, that could be process. It could be events that give them aha experiences and growing. But if there's some sort of fundamental resistance to the truth of reality I'd rather believe my doctrine about what Christianity is than in principle be open to what is true, I think there's something fundamentally wrong there. Because that the motives that drive that kind of belief are not, I don't think those are genuine biblical motives or the motives that the Bible would describe as being real. I think they're more about, they may likely be more about, look, I found a religion that really works for me. I found a community that I'm comfortable in. I believe the same thing as these people, and that feels comfortable to me. I mean, there's all kinds of reasons why we embrace certain kinds of beliefs. And many of those reasons are not that fundamental, biblically based reason of, I really want to embrace this truth that Jesus is talking about here, about my fundamental need, my fundamental corruption and need for God to redeem me, to save me. It's real simple in that sense, but profoundly difficult to embrace ultimately. It takes a real miracle for somebody to actually embrace that, I think. I don't know if that addresses you.
Thanks, everybody, for coming.